Good morning. On Monday, the death was announced of former SDLP leader, Nobel laureate and peacemaker, John Hume. On Wednesday, his funeral mass was held at St Eugene's Cathedral in his native Derry. And in his homily, Father Paul Farran spoke of John Hume's strength, courage and commitment to peace.
And we should never underestimate how difficult it was for John to cross the road and to do what was intensely unpopular for the greater good. It was compassion, a compassion that visibly bubbled over in the graveyard in Greysteel, that drove John on the final and often lonely and always difficult road to peace. Even in the darkest moments, when people would have been forgiven for having no hope, John made peace visible for others. We give thanks to God for the gift of life itself that so many people have today simply because of John's vision of peace, of his commitment to peace, and of his ability to make peace a reality. Because make no mistake about it, there are people alive today who would not be alive had it not been for John's vision and his work.
And all week long, tributes were paid to the Derry activist whose courage and vision had helped secure peace for people on this island. Here is Gavin Jennings opening Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
In different times, the death of a statesman, an internationally renowned peacemaker, and the man credited with pulling Derry out of poverty and single-mindedly dragging Ireland to peace would have filled his native city with well-wishers and friends from across the island and more. Many who would like to, and in their tributes over the last 24 hours have, thanked the 83-year-old for saving lives from a conflict that at its darkest in the 1970s, 80s and 90s looked like it would never end. The Good Friday Agreement of 1998, which brought an end, was born of Hume's analysis and aided by his long years of talks with Republicans during the worst of the violence. In September 1994, on the steps of government buildings, a few days after the Provisional IRA's announcement of a ceasefire, John Hume appeared with Gerry Adams and then Taoiseach Albert Reynolds.
What we're trying to do here, in the first instance, is to sustain a peace process that has been started by a momentous and historic decision of last Wednesday night.
The statement is calling on everyone, and I would say to the British government and to all the parties in the North as well, calling on everyone to use all their energies to produce agreement. And as we reiterate, the process in which we're engaged offers no threat to any section of our people. And in particular, could I say to the Unionist people of the North, as the statement says, we cannot solve this problem without you. We need your agreement too.
On Monday's News at One, Christopher McKevitt spoke to Gerry Adams about his relationship with John Hume.
Can you take us back to 1986, a very dark period in the history of this island, and John Hume reaching out to the Republican movement?
In 1986, it was Father Alex Reeves who reached out to John Hume. Himself and Des Wilson had tried to get talks with the Catholic bishops, with Seamus Mallon, God rest him, of the SDLP. And when all of that failed, he then wrote to John Hume. Father Alex and Father Des had been working with me on the general proposition that the politics of condemnation and of denunciation weren't good enough, that you had to go beyond that, you had to develop an alternative. John was dead set against the IRA constantly. That was his his main focus. But when the good Father Alex outlined in the letter that an alternative maybe could be developed, then John met with Father Alex and then shortly afterwards met with me. There was perhaps 12 years between then and the Good Friday Agreement, so a lot of our talks were private, were secret. And I suppose John's most significant contribution wasn't just in those talks, but was when he was vilified and denounced by elements of the Southern establishment, that he stuck with it and we continued to meet despite everything.
And on Monday morning, when the news had just broken, Marty Morrissey spoke to former Ulster Unionist David Trimble.
You won a Nobel Peace Prize together, you worked together at different sides, but yet you kept that dialogue going and that determination to bring peace to Northern Ireland.
Yes, and of course, we've known that John has been in poor health for some time now. But notwithstanding that fact, we've realised that this day would come. It still comes with a bit of a shock, and one has to adjust with it. The important thing to bear in mind is that that agreement has been a success, unlike all the other initiatives that were brought forward over the years with regard to Northern Ireland, but this one succeeded, and largely because they got the architecture right. In particular, they got right the process for making decisions, and those decisions were based on the agreement of the relevant parties, and it was that bottom-up process that worked, and again will work. But John will be remembered for that. He'll also be remembered for the fact that right from the outset of the troubles in Northern Ireland, he was opposed to violence and was making it clear time and time again that people had to achieve their objectives by peaceful and democratic means.
And their shared hope for peace was reflected in the celebrations when they were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
When we came back from the ceremony to the hotel, we saw that the hotel was operating on the assumption that the SDLP would want to relax and celebrate the occasion in that big room, and in another big room they assumed that the Oceania's party would want to have their celebration of the occasion. And we said, no, put the two rooms together. We're going to do this jointly. Mm. And that's what we did that night. And I was very encouraged by it because I thought we're effectively laying down, or making it clear to people how we intend to proceed. And that, I thought, was a very useful thing.
David Trimble with Marty Morrissey. And a key figure in getting all sides to the table was President Bill Clinton, who just before 6 o'clock took a call with Philip Boucher-Hayes on Monday's Drive Time to pay tribute to the peace he had helped broker. And he recalled a very loud and heartfelt welcome he had received in Derry.
One moment in particular that stands out for many people, and that's your visit with Mrs. Clinton to the Guildhall Square in Derry. What are your memories of that day?
Oh, I remember it so vividly. You know, John had told me that I needed to come to Derry for reasons that were obvious. And I remember wondering what the reception would be, what the mood would be. And when I got there and I saw the square was full, then all the streets leading down to the square were full for several blocks back, that's when I knew, in a way, in the end, it was going to happen, even that early. I mean, I remember so well Phil Coulter singing "The Town I Love So Well" and looking at the eyes of the people in the crowd. And they wanted a different future. They wanted it. You could just see it. And it was chilling. I still think of it often. It was one of the most moving moments that I experienced as president.
And President Clinton remembered not only a peacemaker, but someone who had become a friend.
You couldn't help befriending him. Particularly, it was easy for me because I shared his goals, you know, and we wanted to get to a peace agreement. But I also appreciated the fact that he had fought so long and so hard and still managed to be a real person with a real life. And he knew perfectly well that if the SDLP succeeded, that then people would be a little bit afraid of it, and it would tend to be, then both communities would tend to elect people who would take a harder line than his party did. And he knew there would be a political cost, but it paled him. It was as nothing to the goal of giving the children of Northern Ireland a peaceful future. So I just admired him, and I liked him, and he was good company. I loved being with him.
President Bill Clinton on Monday's Drive Time. The following morning, Rachel English spoke to Monica McWilliams, founder of the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition, and she recalled John Hume's activism and his courage.
You worked with John Hume then in the 1990s, but your memories of him go back a long way.
They do indeed. I remember him as a very young girl, in fact, on the McGilligan Beach during the Civil Rights March. It wasn't a good day in terms of the CS gas that was being fired most unexpectedly, as we were unarmed. There was only sand. And when the rubber bullet started, John marched straight up to the line and asked the commander of the British Army that day to just, one, explain himself, and two, to stop firing the bullets at us. He took some abuse, and it was remarkable that a man who was a Member of Parliament was being treated in such a way, but he did not give up. He didn't give up that day, and he never gave up since. And the thing that I think he should be remembered for was his inclusive spirit. He was wanting to hear from all, and he reached out his hand to create peace when others were reaching fists and worse, were reaching guns. That was incredible. It was really hard to do that. I know that because many of us were trying to create back channels and were being cursed as a result. And it does take a toll on your health, and it did take a toll on his.
Monica McWilliams on Morning Ireland. And it was to John Hume's native Derry that former pupil, friend and community activist Dennis Bradley looked when he spoke to Sarah McInerney on Tuesday.
He never left the Bogside. I mean, John stayed in his own street, in his own house, in his own street. And even though it was petrol bombed one time, it was attacked, it was vulnerable, I'm sure the security and the police and so forth would have said to him, you should be living in a more safe area. He never left that spot. And I think that added to his authority, because he was not just some man who had come in from the outside, not somebody who had been there but had now left his people behind him and was kind of talking in a fashion which was external. He was of the place, he was in the place, he knew the place, he knew the people, and that I think gave him an authority out and beyond that which is quite often in or not in politics when it comes to real change, not just in external small economic issues, but in constitutional, passionate, historical issues.
And as people reflected on the activist, politician and the man, a picture emerged of tenacity and courage. Here's former President Mary McAleese on Monday's News at One.
He had a capacity for patience and endurance like nobody I have ever encountered. My heart goes out to his wonderful wife, Pat, and children today, who really gifted him to us. No one will ever know what sacrifices they endured all those years to let him be the light that he was to all of us. There's just no argument. We would not have the Good Friday Agreement without John Hume. The fundamental analysis on which it is based, the idea of tackling the three separate sets of relationships and giving them each a place in an agreed settlement was genius. That was his genius. His fingerprints are all over that agreement. So what we enjoy today, we enjoy thanks to him. The sun shines today. Thank God it does after a period of rain. And I think the sun shines on John this day and on Derry this day that gave us this gift. And he was God's gift to all of us. He was a Dan O'Connell, actually, of our generation. And incidentally, the man who completed the vision of Dan O'Connell.
President Mary McAleese on the News at One. However, achieving that peace was a long and difficult road. And fellow Derry native and friend Phil Coulter spoke to Sarah McInerney about the toll those dark days and years had taken on his family and John Hume's own health.
And what about the personal toll on him, though, Phil? Because he was under a lot of attack for his work and for his stance and for talking to Gerry Adams and all of that. How did you see that toll?
Obvious, sir. I saw them with my own eyes. On the gable wall opposite John Hume's front door, Traitor Hume was with graffiti that was there for a long, long time. I mean, his house was protected with steel and wire or whatever. Was it protected against who? Well, about extremists on both sides. I mean, at one time, John has been vilified from left, right and centre. There's no doubt about that. And John, I think at the end of the day, when John retired, John Hume was just spent. John Hume had given everything that he could give. There was nothing left in the tank. And that's why John's latter years, sadly, he was, you know, he had serious health issues, the dementia, etc. I think John Hume just gave his last ounce. I really do.
But John Hume's loyalty to the Bogside and the Derry people was something they were happy to repay in his later years when he was ill. Here's journalist Susan McKay with Sarah McInerney, and she had interviewed John Hume's wife, Pat.
One of the lovely things that she said when I talked to her was she said that John had, Derry was turning into a city of kindness. And she was referring to the fact of, you know, that various journalists and others have referred to, particularly movingly, Aoife Grace Moore talked of it, the fact that while he had dementia, he would still walk about Derry and he'd walk out the foyle and taxi drivers would bring him home and people would join him on his walks just to make sure he was okay, and people didn't repeat, you know, silly things that he had said. You know, they let them pass some things because they understood that he had dementia and that he was a great man. Mm. So, you know, I think that Pat and others are very much, you know, they were a very, very highly respected family in this city.
Susan McKay with Sarah McInerney. John Hume was 83 when he died, and his was a life well lived, filled with family, friends, banter and singing. Here's Phil Coulter.
There's a condition amongst Derry people, Sarah, which you have to understand. Everybody in Derry, whether they can or not, thinks that they can sing. I mean, it's a kind of divine right to Derry people believe that they're gifted. But John actually could sing. And, of course, our party piece repeated in high dives and low places for many, many years would have been a duet on The Town I Love So Well, with me at the piano and John at my shoulder.
Now the music's gone, but they carry on, for their spirits been bruised, never broken. They will not forget, but their hearts are set on tomorrow and peace once again. For what's done is done, and what's won lost is lost and gone forever. I can only pray for a bright, brand new day in the town I love so well.
John Hume, Ar Yeshche Groa Anam Dealish. Welcome back. On Brainstorm on Wednesday night, Ella McSweeney was talking bogs with Catherine Farrell, who traced their evolution from 10,000 years ago when glaciers gave way to gravel and then plants moved in on bare soil, and the role in particular played by one moss.
So this moss is called sphagnum. It's a really interesting species. I get very excited when I talk about it because for a small and very almost insignificant looking when you see the individual plants, but it actually can create the conditions which make it hostile for other plants to grow, which means it makes the environment around it acidic, which means, you know, very few other species can grow there, but also it keeps it wet. So it's like this big fluffy sponge, mm-hmm. which just absorbs water, keeps it there, and then it just keeps growing up and up, and it just brings the water table up around and brings a few plants with it. So it brings things like sundews and insectivorous species and some of the heathers. So these are really specialised species that can actually grow in this very waterlogged, inhospitable environment.
And so, you know, I remember reading the great cartographer, the late Tim Robinson, describing bogs as life swallowed up and forgotten.
Mm. Yeah, well, he just was a poet in so many ways, and he got it, like Heaney as well. You know, these are like mind-boggling in a way, 10,000 years of history encapsulated. And not only that, it records everything that happened in and around those bogs. So it records when the first people came to Ireland. It records the history of agriculture. It records when the bogs actually dried out and they were colonised by Scots pine and oak and all these sorts of things. So there's a whole museum there in terms of the record, a history book.
Catherine Farrell on Brainstorm, talking about bogs, the unique and rather beautiful gift beneath our feet. Over on the Collins Collection, Ronan was treated to Gavin James doing Dylan at speed.
I think I know. I won't remember any of the words, but it was a... Well, Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement thinking about the government. A man in a trench coat, flash out, laid off, says he's got a bad car, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, some you did. Well, God knows when, but you're doing it again. You're going up down the alleyway looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap and a pig pen wants $11 bills. You've only got 10. It's that kind of a... I used to love that. Then it would go faster. It'd be like... Oh, Megaton, Fleetfoot, face full of black suit, talk about the heat, put plants in the bed books. Phone tapped anyway, Maggie says, and many said the must bust an enemy orders from the DA. Look out, kid, scum, you did. Walk on your tiptoes, don't try no blows. Better stay away from those that carry on a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, buy some clean clothes. You don't need the weatherman to know which way the wind blows. That kind of... So you used to love doing that song because it just kept getting faster and faster.
He's flying at us. That was Gavin James with Ronan Collins on the Collins Collection. Liveline continued to hear from listeners who had lost money, often pretty big sums of money, through a scam which mimics the Bank of Ireland text line. Messages are sent to customers, sometimes including a link which asks for confidential PIN numbers, which allows the fraudsters to access your account. Now, the bank is saying that this is criminal activity, not their fault, and nothing to do with their own systems, and as such, they bear no responsibility. And the customer, well, they should have known better. On Wednesday, though, Joe Duffy was less than impressed.
Well, the development in the Bank of Ireland scandal is, as you've been listening to it now for nearly 10 days on Liveline, people get texts, as you know, from the Bank of Ireland. And these are texts about COVID or whatever, but they're genuine Bank of Ireland texts. And then on the same thread, on the exact same screen, in comes another text saying your account has been compromised. And obviously people think it's on the same thread that is from the Bank of Ireland. Please click this link and we'll help you. Now, Francesca McDonough, the CEO of the Bank of Ireland, was on Morning Ireland this morning, and almost without exception, the Bank of Ireland have said it's nothing to do with us. You gave your details. By the way, this is what Francesca McDonough said this morning when she was asked about the scam.
Incredibly important for customers not to divulge their personal login details, one-time passwords or their full PINs to anyone. It is like leaving, giving someone the keys to your car or dropping your wallet on the street. I mean, you're making yourself very, very vulnerable to fraud. And if people are suspicious of any transaction, they should certainly raise it. And we will never text a customer asking them for confidential information like some of these criminals have done.
Bank of Ireland CEO Francesca McDonough. And that car analogy... Well, that was the loose thread that Joe began to pull.
Darren, good afternoon. Did you hear what Francesca McDonough said? You left your car keys. You gave someone your car keys. That was your fault.
Yeah, well, Joe, it's quite shocking to think that that's the reply that people are getting. And like the answer, it's where's the duty of care from Bank of Ireland in the first place? I feel that they have to put a stone wall up, because if they engage or sympathise in any way, they have no reply or they have no answer to people, because, they may say that they don't send us texts to ask for details, but surely with this is going on months now, why have they not told people who have accounts with Bank of Ireland that, our number can be compromised and you may well receive texts from other people?
Well, what they're saying is in their original statement to Liveline, they wouldn't come on Liveline, unfortunately.
And
the original statement to Liveline, they said this scam is common to many institutions, not just the Bank of Ireland. It's common to social welfare. It's common to, I think they mentioned other banks. So we're looking for examples from other banks. What did you lose, by the way?
Just under 3,000 euros.
Sorry. How much was robbed on you?
Yeah, that's more like 3,000 euros. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And it was robbed on you on the Bank of Ireland thread, text thread.
Yep.
And the Bank of Ireland say, you gave your keys to your car to somebody.
And they kept coming.
Raymond, good afternoon. How much did you lose, Raymond?
I lost short 6,000, John.
And in Francesca McDonald's words, where did you leave your car keys so the thieves could take your car keys? That's what you did. It's like giving your keys to your car away.
Yeah, well, when you went into this website, Joe, like the previous man there, it looked very good. The interface looked very well. It was all well laid out, like, you know, and that's all they can say, I suppose, the Bank of Ireland.
And the Bank of Ireland is saying, hands up, nothing to do with us, not even a word of sympathy.
And here's Michael.
Michael, how much did you lose?
So, Joe, on the 30th of June, I lost €4,925. I got the text, scrolled back up to see that it was through my message feed in Bank of Ireland, clicked the link to see what the suspicious activity was.
Yeah.
So I entered my details and I gave the one-time passcode.
That they gave you?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Not your one-time, that they supplied to you?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Now, Michael, have you ever been stopped on the street at random, Michael, by somebody saying, hello, Michael, can I have your car keys, please?
Yeah, no, and look, I was listening to what Francesca said and I was just thinking there as the other people were talking. Like, if somebody came up to you, yeah, at the ATM and said, look, give me your card, give me what, yeah, you have, you know, and they took your money, as hard as it would be, I think you'd feel a bit better, because this is a horrible experience. You have nowhere to turn, nowhere to go, no answers, you know. Yeah. It's
and no responsibility been taken.
Yeah.
Have you got the same response from the bank as everyone else? It's your hard luck, you gave your car keys away.
That's this, yeah. If you look through their terms and conditions, they say that you're responsible for your details.
Okay. If anyone has given their car keys away, it could have been a gesture of charity to someone who randomly stopped them on the street. Could they contact us on 51551, wash your hands of this, Bank of Ireland.
Liveline on Wednesday, and of course it must be said the Bank of Ireland continues to stress that the fault lies not with their bank or the banking system. And of course, don't give away your car keys. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Well, as we now know, phase 4 of the reopening has been pushed out and pubs will be staying closed for another 3 weeks at least. A loss for a whole load of people in terms of their social life and getting out and about, and a particular blow for families struggling to keep businesses afloat. But in the face of the devastation that is COVID-19, whether or not there's scope for leeway on this, well... Paul Moynihan, the incoming president of the Vintners Federation of Ireland, spoke on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
I think it's been proven that the pubs that have been open so far for 5 weeks now, I think it's been proven that there's been no cases associated with these pubs so far. So where is the evidence that says that we cannot as an industry go forward and keep this pandemic at bay? I think everything that was being asked of us as an industry has been done and would be done. Listen, you're talking about people's livelihoods here. You're talking about 30,000 jobs involved in this industry. You've got publicans, you've got their families, you've got the people that are working for us, you've got the people that are supplying us. I'm a pub in a small village here in Dunard. In the same sentence yesterday, Micheál Martin mentioned pubs and nightclubs. Now, if you took a look at my pub and compare it and put it in the same sentence as a nightclub with maybe 500 people jammed into it, is completely ludicrous. You cannot put them in the same sentence. So if my pub is a local pub, I probably know every single person that comes in here. We're all neighbours. We're all friends. We're trying our best to move forward as a nation in this. To keep me closed and the likes of all rural publicans closed is absolutely ridiculous.
And that view was echoed later that morning when Sarah McInerney spoke to independent TD for Kerry, Michael Healy-Ray, because when it came to rural pubs, he's having none of it.
The pubs that we're talking about wouldn't have 4 or 5 or 6 people inside them at any time. And you'd be talking about social distancing. And, I mean, you couldn't be in a safer place than be in one of those type of pubs. So I really think the government aren't listening. They're treating our publicans and their customers with contempt.
Contempt? Well, texters in were also having their say.
Lots of texts coming in. This one saying, honestly, the outrage, the unfairness, anyone would think we were fighting an unpredictable global pandemic or something.
Right. You see, it's very easy for a person to make a statement like that. But can I ask a question? And I ask this inside the dollar. And I directly ask the person that sent in what we'll call a smart enough type of a comment like that. Can they explain to me the medical difference between me being inside in a restaurant tonight and a pint of Guinness in one of my hands and a toasted cheese sandwich in the other hand. Or else, if I'm inside in what they call a wet pub with just a pint of Guinness in my hand, what is the difference? And with regard to public health, where is the difference and where is the basis for making the decision to keep those pubs closed? What is the medical information that they're basing this decision on? They're basing it on nonsense. Right. They're basing it on the fact that they're so removed from reality. And as far as I can see now, the more people that are asking them to open the pubs, the less likely that they are that they're going to do it.
Also on the line was Dr. Gabriel Scally, President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine in London. And for him, the figures spoke for themselves.
Alcohol is the virus's best friend. And if you want proof of that, you just have to look what's just happened in Scotland, where they've opened their pubs and they've now had one outbreak in one pub with 32 people infected. 32 people just from one pub. The only safe thing to do, I'm afraid, and I'm disappointed not being able to go to my local pub myself, but that's what we have to do. The only safe thing to do is to keep them shut for the time being.
Dr. Gabriel Scally with Sarah McInerney on Wednesday. Drink, but in this case too much of it, and an inability to shout stop was the focus of a new book from writer and one-time girl about town, Bryony Gordon. She spoke to Catherine Thomas about marking 3 years without alcohol, and in her own mind, she didn't conform to the idea she had had of an alcoholic.
I'd sort of spent my whole life trying to prove I wasn't an alcoholic to myself, you know. I couldn't be because I didn't drink during the day and I had rules, you know. I drank after seven and then towards the end of my drinking I only drank session ale because I could just keep going and going. And, you know, alcoholics didn't have rules, did they? And I thought I was in control of my drinking, but really my drinking controlled me. And it didn't really matter that I wasn't drinking all day because I was thinking about drinking all day. It was like... it was in charge of the show. And I was so ashamed of that. You know, I had a 4-year-old daughter, now seven, and I thought this isn't what mothers do. And then I went to treatment. I was very lucky to get to treatment and I discovered it's exactly what some mothers do, you know, and I wasn't a bad person. I was an ill person who sometimes did bad things as a result of that illness. And it was such a relief to me. And I thought it would be really disingenuous not for me to kind of write this book.
And for her, as she freely admitted, one drink was never enough.
The idea of having one drink to me is like horrific. I can't even begin to tell you. So if someone came up with some sort of medication and they said, Bryony, they've come up with this medication which helps you to moderate, so you'd only want one or two, I wouldn't want to take it. Like for me, when I picked up a drink, it was about oblivion. It was about blacking out. It was about numbing myself.
Was it always about that?
Well, I mean, yes, essentially it was.
And this was her rock bottom.
I'd gone out bank holiday weekend and I'd gone to meet someone. I would have drunk with anyone as long as they didn't comment on how much I drank. So it was someone I didn't even really know. And I went and I met them and ended up drinking and taking drugs with them until the small hours. And I was supposed to be back, you know, to leave with my family to go away for a bank holiday weekend away. And of course, I didn't make it back. And I sort of came round in my quote unquote friend's house to a lot of messages from my husband saying you cannot continue doing this, you're putting us through hell. And it was the worst text message I'd ever received, but in a way it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because, you know, that's why it's called Glorious Rock Bottom. I'm under no illusion, alcoholism is absolutely awful, and that those moments were terrible, and the pain, it was just like, it can still bring me to tears now. But I needed to get there. But I'm also under no illusion that if I picked up a drink, I wouldn't go, it wouldn't be worse. Like, I remember my counsellor telling me that addiction is a lift going down, and you can choose to get off wherever you want, but if you get back on, you are going lower and lower and lower. You know, and that's the thing about that thing of like, oh well, I haven't lost everything, I've got a job, I'm reasonably successful, so I can't be an alcoholic. It's like, well, yeah, you've still got a job now, but why wait for the terrible, terrible, terrible thing to happen to like shake you out of your stupor? And I, you know, that was bad enough, but I knew that you know, I knew that the logical place was I was going to lose my child, and I was going to lose my husband and everything that I held dear, really. Mm.
Bryony Gordon talking to Catherine Thomas about her book, Glorious Rock Bottom. Over on Sunday Miscellany, Gerald Daw brought us this poem.
Swimmer for Milo. He was diving as if his life depended on it. And from where we sat, lording it over the slow tide and morning mist, recall the swallow dive, the soaking pads of his feet, the back flip, the outrageous belly flop that brought us up short before, like a veteran, he lapped up the last of the sun on his face, the curious night music of cicada and olive trees whispering about the silent hours. A shuttered house.
Swimmer by Gerald Daw is heard on Sunday Miscellany. On Bank Holiday Monday on Like Family, Brenda Donoghue was getting all mushy. She talked to Kelly and Fionn about love in the time of COVID. Now, their wedding had had to be postponed. But before we got to that, she started by asking them how they'd met.
We both worked together in the newsagents in Tallaght Hospital, and it just blossomed from there. And I eventually worked up the courage and asked her out, and then one thing led to another, and 12 years later, we're still going strong, thank God.
Yeah. Thank God, yeah. We just knew, didn't we? We really did. Like, he's a great...
Hit it off.
I've an eldest lad. He's 17, so he'd be a stepson to Fionn, and he was amazing to Stephen. And I just knew, like, you know, he was the one.
I just saw the way she is with everybody, and she's a great person. And
he made me laugh as well. That's the most important thing. You know, I think when someone makes you laugh, you know, it brightens up your day.
Yeah,
definitely.
100%,
yeah.
You all right?
Yeah.
That's okay. Why are you crying, Kelly?
It's just because we've been through so much. And he's always been there. He's just my rock. That's all I'll say. Like, it's just we've had a tough the last few years with me being sick and...
Kelly was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2016, and she has been through the mill with Fionn at her side through all of it. But even though a full wedding is on hold, the couple decided to head to Dunard in County Wicklow for a commitment ceremony in the woods. And get yourself a few hankies, because these were their vows.
You're so caring, loving, beautiful. And I'm punching well above my weight, to be honest with you. I love you, everything, from the bottom to the top. I love you, sweetheart.
Fionn, because of you, I smile and I laugh every day. Because of you, we shared the most amazing children. Because of you, I got through the toughest 2 years of my life. Because of you, I am me. You're my rock, you're my best friend, and most of all, you're my soulmate. And this is the reason why I love you so much.
Oh, that was beautiful. Kelly and Fionn on Like Family. Yesterday was Oliver's last day in the seat for Ryan, and he spoke to writer Kevin Barry about his new film, Dark Lies the Island.
What we were going for, Oliver, I think, is we wanted like an especially raunchy episode of Dallas, set in Roscommon, with a kind of touch of David Lynch around the edges. We totally achieved it. Yeah. It was what I did was I took characters from six different short stories, and I put them all into some same small kind of North Midlands town over the course of a week, and see what happened when they all collided, and it turned into a very strange, heated family gothical romance kind of a situation. We filmed it all up around Roscommon and Leitrim and stuff, so people were enjoying it as a film, but they were also trying to figure out where's that now exactly and where's that, you know. It was kind of great. It was great. My nearest town for the shopping is Boyle, so when I was in there, there was a scene being filmed in Boyle, a funeral, and I was behind two old ladies in the super value queue, you know, and they were saying, who's dead?
Jesus, who's dead now? There's someone dead. And they've seen a hearse gone down, and they were trying to. They went through half the town trying to figure out who hadn't been looking great the last while.
Oh, man down in Boyle, or maybe not. But then Oliver asked the question that we're all asking of each other: how had Kevin Barry found lockdown?
110 nights in a row at home, I think, cooking the dinner. So that was unusual. And it was kind of, it's a weird one, you know. It's kind of a very different thing in the countryside compared to being in the city with it. In the countryside, it looks the same outside your window. The cows are the same, all cows. True. The hills are the same. Whereas when you get to a town, you realise, wow, this is actually really weird, you know. Just wandering around Galway the other day, it was my first day in the city in 3 months, and I was like, God, this thing is real, you know. It's kind of strange, and it's you feel a bit odd when you're walking out the more ghostly seeming parts of town.
I mean, it's a kind of a thread in your novels and all your work over the years that there's kind of a bit, like, particularly for the West Coast, there's the kind of the thing of the sea, the big thing looming out there.
Yeah.
So in the countryside, even though you can't see it, I suppose the anxiety was you can't go anywhere. And do you think it's kind of a connection that there was something big and ghostly and gargantuan hanging out there?
Yeah, do you know what I mean? I often think if you thought of the west of Ireland, if you thought of the western seaboard of Ireland as a person, what kind of a person would it be? And I would say you could sum it up in one word: rattled. They're slightly shook. We tend to be in the west of Ireland. And I think it's, you know, very big things in our lives can have huge effects on our moods and temperaments, and they're so big we can't even see them. I think living on the edge of the Atlantic has Irish people a bit rattled all the time, you know, a bit nervy, a bit agitated. So it definitely has an effect on our personality. But I do think our places really influences us people, you know, what make us the kind of people we are. And it's something that my work feeds off all the time, I think, really.
Are they extra rattled, or are they maybe more prepared for the thing than the rest of us?
This year, I think we're all extra rattled, really, compared to the usual, you know. Yeah, we should be kind of kind to ourselves this year, really, and forgive ourselves our little narky moods and our kind of quiet spells, because it's strange old stuff to be going through.
So go handy on yourself is the message.
Go handy on yourselves, lads.
Go handy, not a bad note on which to finish. That is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I'm on my holidays for 2 weeks, so chat to you on my return. Oh, and that's the sound of a hammock. And a pina colada. Possibly in the rain.